This is the Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joseph Cohen from Queens College in the City University of New York.
I'm Sarah Patterson from the University of Michigan.
I'm Dan Morrison from Abilene Christian University.
Today, we have an extra special treat for all of you. Nathan Alabach, social media manager, and the person behind, wait for it, Steak'em Twitter. That's right, Soch Twitter. We got the guy behind Steak'em Twitter. You know about it. You know who he is. You love it. And today, we're going to meet him and find out what makes him tick. Steak'em on Soch Annex, coming up. We are here with Nathan Alabach, the person behind Steak'em Twitter is here. Welcome, Nathan.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, everybody.
I'm also joined by two co-hosts today. You remember them both, Sarah Patterson from the University of Michigan. Sarah, great to see
Hello.
You again.
Yep.
And Daniel Morrison from Abilene Christian University down in Texas. Great to see you again, Dan.
Great to be with you both.
So this is an extremely interesting interview for several reasons, and I wanted to preface the interview by talking about why I'm so excited to speak to Nathan. First of all, Nathan is a very successful popularizer of the kind of work we do. Part of my interest in meeting him is to get a sense of what he's doing and why he thinks everything he's doing is resonating and maybe learn something about communicating with the public. Second, in the grand division of labor of our system of information and communications, people like Nathan are the types of people who we might want to approach to pass on what we create, the knowledge we create, the information we create. And I was curious about, you know, what he feels we do well or we do badly or how we can reach out to people like Nathan better. And I hope we could talk about that today. And finally, Nathan is it a very, very interesting field, one that's very close to my heart. I think academia attracts a lot of communicators. Sociology, it's a foundation of marketing, and maybe some of our listeners who are, you know, involved in soc and are interested in doing what Nathan does for a living might be interested in hearing from him. So with all that in mind, it's great to have you here, Nathan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, the pleasure's mine. I'm excited to chat.
All right, so let's start off. Can you start off by introducing yourself? Like, who are you? What do you do? Why sociology? I get the sense you didn't even know, but why is sociology so into what you do?
Well, first off, Joe, I'm just some guy. I think that's important to sort of like bar low. I'm a social media manager. I'm a creative director at a really small ad agency outside the Philly area that specializes in mostly food and beverage style brands. The Steak'em stuff started in 2017, just to kind of give like a brief overview. We had been working with this brand for 2 years prior to that and doing some cool work with them, but nothing on social media besides like ad type stuff. And they had ran their annual budget by the summer of 2017. So we had all this extra time, and there's a long backstory to this, but basically our agency wasn't doing too hot at that period. We had just lost a couple big clients. So mm-hmm. I had a lot of free time while we were there, and I just pitched to the client like, hey, there's this vacant Twitter account that you have. It's got 1,000 inactive followers. There might be conversations on this platform that we can explore. And to be honest, I didn't know much about Twitter. Like let me rephrase this. I'd been on Twitter since 2009, but not when I look at how Twitter is used now, I was not a Twitter user. Like I used it to sort of like personal journal, like random things I was doing into the void. Like I didn't engage with other communities. Like I wasn't really active in any meaningful way. So once I started getting involved through the Steak'em account and discovering all these online communities and just all the weird happenings of the sort of 24/7 news buzz, it was blowing my mind, and just trying to like absorb as much as I could over those first few months. And it was just a lot of trial and error, just figuring out, you know, what was resonating with people, what isn't resonating with people. And eventually it just started clicking. And then once it started clicking, it kind of snowballed. It started going viral a couple times. And I think the account like really took off at the end of 2018. So about a year into it, and we had this viral thread about like the struggles that young people, I guess predominantly millennials, are facing today. And it was just kind of, it wasn't meant to be this super serious thing. It was just kind of like a commentary that I had been producing through the brand for the past few months. And for whatever reason, this one resonated for across the board. It hit national headlines. People loved it. People hated it. And that kind of defined the brand voice. And then once that happened, it kind of became more of a full-time kind of like embodiment of my work. And I had to sort of embrace the dystopian nature of what we were doing, because the guy had the bag. So it was like, all right, well, this is what it is. Now we have to kind of explore this. And up to that point, we were doing different stuff. You know, we're doing, you know, memes and just various forms of ads and whatnot. And once that kind of became the defining thing for the brand, it was like, oh crap, all right, well, now I guess we gotta see where this goes. So that's how I came into it. But just to, I guess, 10 more seconds, I don't have like a crazy academic background. I'm a liberal studies major. I've taken a handful of philosophy, psych, soc classes, flunked a couple of them. not like a super well-studied guy, but I do love learning, and that's what I spend most of my free time doing. So I guess that's kind of how I am able to weirdly juggle that kind of content into the marketing that we do.
Yeah, when I first reached out to Nathan,
Joe was a fangirl.
Oh yeah. But I was like, okay, I wonder whose student he is. This is clearly a graduate student. He just had such a knack for sociology. And you might not catch it in Nathan's response, but like, he is not trained in I shouldn't say not trained. You have a liberal studies degree, it's really just a passing acquaintance. You kind of got into it, I guess.
And there's so many people who I know exist on Twitter. I don't know if they're fans of your podcast, but I know they're out there who would hear you say something like that and just they're cringing at this recording, just being like, oh, this is blowing so much smoke up this guy's ass. Because there's so many people that their main criticism of what Stakem produces is like, well, these are all just kind of like 101 talking points from these like miscellaneous liberal studies courses. To which I say, absolutely, they are. But it's my job to communicate them. And that's sort of like where the interesting tension is. It's like, okay, yeah, it's one thing to say, okay, this is a really basic idea. It's not super hard for somebody to grasp. It's another thing to be able to communicate that effectively. And that's something that I don't know how good or bad I am at that on the aggregate, but I do, for the posts, I take sometimes weeks sharpening them and making it like, you know, it's like a formula, just figuring out like, how are you going to get this? Like, who's going to think what when they read this? You know, like, what's the backlash going to be? Like, what are the ups and downs of the potential outcomes? So that's something I have to put a lot of thought into with that kind of work, since it is marketing, you know?
Yeah. Although, you know, the credentialism is always where people go when they got nothing substantive to say. Right. I got to tell you, right? And on a blind read, like, I recognized some of the articles you were channeling. Like, they were real articles. Tina Fetner was on. I think she was like, oh, look, Stakem read Paul DiMaggio or something like that.
Yeah, that is, I guess that is interesting. Like, sometimes you can read a certain, like a talking point or like a term, and you're like, oh, I know the video or the article or the book that this is most likely referenced from. It is fun being able to pick that out in people's work.
But I want to just clarify. So you were trying on the Twitter account, you were trying different content, you were trying different voices. And when you started getting into sort of this, I guess it's like social science informed commentary, it's very sociological. That's what resonated with audiences, and you just kept on going at it. Is that?
Yeah, I think it was the sort of both sides, like the on the one hand, it's commentary that resonates because it's true and it's kind of basic and easy enough for the average person to grasp. Like they read this laid out version of a concept and they're like, okay, I get that. But then the flip side to that is the fact that it's coming from a frozen meat brand. And I think that's where the absurdity of it is. And I tell people all the time, like, I run a lot of brand accounts, and I've run a lot of brand accounts over the years. I've never been able to replicate, not that I shouldn't say the success, because the time I spent on Stakem just blows any time I've spent on any other brand out of the water. But in terms of like getting that level of attention, it's so rare in marketing in general. And I think so much of it is that juxtaposition between, you know, here's content that is a value add to people's timeline or whatever, but then you juxtapose that with the fact that it's coming from this absurd meat product, and that makes it this like entertaining, absurdist thing that people can then laugh about while they're consuming the media. So it has that kind of infotainment aspect to it.
What do you think made Twitter the magic pill? You know, like, what was that about versus Instagram or TikTok or all the other options that you might, I don't know if you use them, but you know.
It's an interesting question because this is something any new brand I work with or agency or whatever, we're always trying to pitch Twitter through to them, like the sort of importance of it, because it's not in like the top five main platforms that people think about when you think social media. And I think for me, it comes, I mean, it's so many things, but I guess it comes down to one, Twitter is one of the last remaining organic platforms that you can like really grow a presence on, whether you're an individual or a brand or an institution or whatever. That along with like TikTok, they're probably the easiest to grow on organically. So that's like a huge selling point. I mean, if you're going up into Instagram or Facebook for the first time, or even YouTube, it's super hard to break through without like a paid budget at any scale. So that's like the main thing. But then two, it's just, it's where culture happens. Like, I don't know how else to explain. I mean, obviously Twitter, the makeup of Twitter is very specific. You know, it's a little bit elite. It's a little bit, you know, I get the word elite sums it up. I mean, it's a lot of people in cities. It's a lot of high media, journalists, writers, academics, et cetera. So obviously it's not completely representative of the US or the world at large, but it's because it's driven by those academics, journalists, celebrities, and what have you. There's a lot of just high-paced 24/7 news and current events and trends that are cycled through it quicker than you see almost anywhere else. Maybe Reddit is probably like the most comparable platform where you see these trends kind of like dished out at that pace. So it's a great space for brands to kind of get in at the ground level of a trend, whether it's a meme or a topic of conversation or something that's happening in the world that you want to like make sure that you're on top of, you know, and all those things combined make it a space where you can, one, get attention from journalists or writers or YouTubers or podcasters, whoever you're looking to get attention from. So you can get that attention, which can then translate to earned media. It can translate to monetization in other ways. Like for you guys doing a podcast, obviously it becomes like a sort of audience builder. It's a place where it's like you can find people that will follow you and listen to what you have to say. So all those things combined, it's much more accessible for people trying to monetize whatever it is they're doing than Instagram or Facebook or any of these other platforms that just take longer and more commitment, I think, to build over time.
I mean, I was just interested in this idea of resonance, right? And the people who use the platform and this, like, you know, this somewhat academic, but also still relatable content. And so putting those two together seems like the spark in this case. I don't know that whether that's replicable, right, necessarily for any other brands, because I do think you get a lot of mileage out of the fact that this is a frozen meat company, right? I mean, this is not like, it's not the New Yorker, yeah, right? I mean, the New Yorker's Twitter feed is a totally separate thing, and you would maybe expect, you know, quotes from Paul DiMaggio or whomever, you know? But it does add an extra dimension, yeah, I think, to it, you know?
And I think that's something, I talk to colleagues and people in the industry that we're trying to pitch to often about that exact thing, where sometimes I'll test it even on myself, where I'll take an exact tweet that we do through Stakem and I'll post it on my personal account, which isn't huge. I mean, I've got like, I don't know, it's like somewhere over 15,000 followers, something like that. I'm not like highly engaged, but it's enough where, you know, if it's a good tweet, it'll get hopefully amplified into the, you know, the algorithm or whatever. And it never performs the same. I mean, it's like, it's a completely different tone. It's a completely different message when it's filtered through this absurdist brand versus a person, or like you said, versus another institution. Like, it already kind of comes across preachy in a way that some people find condescending and obnoxious, but other people who even might see that, they let it slide because they're like, oh, well, it's a meat brand doing it. So it's kind of the condescension, you know? But if it's a person saying that, like, even for me, if I were to read some of the stuff that I've written from a person, I'd be like, man, like, what a douche, you know? Like, that's not cool. Like, it sounds very like high and mighty, but I'm aware of that through the brand. It's just not something that it's a lot more hard to replicate as a person or institution. I agree.
So a frozen meat brand can never take itself too seriously because it is frozen meat.
Yes. I mean, well, that is like the sort of, if not the main cornerstone, one of like two or three cornerstones to what's made the brand so successful is the fact that we have constantly for years at this point played into the sort of self-awareness of what we're doing. Like the fact that this is advertising, the fact that advertising is some quasi form of propaganda, depending on what model you're using historically, and how in a lot of ways, like what we're doing isn't great for the world. Like you could argue the content may be helpful to some people, but the fact that it's able to trick people so easily. I mean, like there's so many people who will just like mindlessly follow, mindlessly regurgitate. And even I'll often, like I don't do it as much now. I used to do it all the time. I used to message a lot of the fans or whatever, the followers of the Steak'em account, and be like, you know, this is an ad, right? Like, you know, as you engage, like this is what you're doing. And they'd just be like, yeah, I just don't care, you know? And like, I think that's a weird nihilism of being a person online where like you're so aware that you're hyper desensitized to just all the ads and all, like everybody's like trying to fight for your attention, and it just becomes noise. So when something like this happens that that resonates with you, even if you're aware that you're being advertised to, you just kind of accept it because you're like, well, it's more fun and silly than like some politician or some like propaganda network or something else that's trying to do the same thing. It's almost like a break from that to them, which is a morally contentious thing to deal with. It's like, well, it's not really a break, you know. I'm getting in your subconscious, so it's a weird thing to think about.
Counterpoint, though, it could be that as a product, you're also free from some of the baggage that might turn off people with sort of prejudgments, right? Like if you were a Harvard professor, it'd be like, oh, who's this Harvard asshole? Or, you know, you don't have a Steak'em doesn't have like a race or a social class, or there's just nothing to get pre-pissed off about.
I was gonna say that's exactly it. Like people, because we're so candid about like everything that we do is marketing, everything we do is to further our own bottom line, to sell more product, it does create almost this like sense of relief for people that they're like, oh, well, they're not trying to push me in any direction for some nefarious or unseen reason. Like it's just cut and dry. This is marketing. And that's really a relief to some people, which is both sad, but it's just a reality. Like you said, because you are so used to not, it's like part of what we all do, whether it's in internal messaging or external, like posting into the public square, is always trying to like measure intent and figure out like, what are people's goals? Like what is function of this tweet? Is it a self-aggrandizing thing? Is it something that is for this other purpose that I can't see? And we're always doing that implicitly, even if it's not explicit. So I think it is a kind of like relaxing thing for people to be like, all right, I'm being advertised to, but it is what it is. Like that's all there is going on there. So yeah, maybe they're more receptive then.
Yeah. It's a lower stakes interaction too, you know. There it is. But you know what? You know what? It's also like there's some interesting information there, because it could be like, in fact, I already know the answer to this question, but I'm gonna put it out there. Could part of the problem be that academics are off-putting, and that's what's preventing them from getting audience?
I don't know if it's like, so it's not off. I mean, it is off-putting, but
it is off-putting. Come on,
it's not a core problem to academics. It's to everybody. I mean, it's just everybody who has an opinion that puts it out there, especially from any experts in today's age of like populism and sort of like this innate like hatred toward elites in various spheres. I think people are just like the joke on Twitter is the blue check marks. You know, it's like, oh, here come the blue check marks to this issue, and it's like, oh. It's a way to signal the academics, the journalists, the sort of the politicians, the people who have control over whatever the narrative might be. So I do think, generally speaking, there's that aspect of it to it. But then there's the fact that in the attention economy online, we all have to say and do things to get attention that aren't that go, like you're talking about marketing, how it kind of infuses in your field and almost every field. We all have to figure out ways to frame our messaging that goes beyond the truth of the message. Like there's the truth of the message, which is like, here it is, it's in plain text, but nobody wants to read that. So you have to figure out like to memeify it, you know, make it funny, make it outrageous, make it some kind of bait for people to then want to click on, and then boom, that's how you make your podcast bucks. That's how you make your brand bucks. That's how you get your Patreon money. Like it's what everybody's vying for this economy, or fighting this economy using that strategy. So yes, it's the same strategy that turns people off to academia and these other institutions. It's like, oh, well, they're all playing a game, but it sucks because the economics of it, that's just the game you're forced, or at least you're coerced to play to succeed. So it's tough.
Yeah. Your story reminds me of the Wendy's Twitter and Moon Pie. Moon Pie also had some sort of belligerent tweeting, if I recall correctly. It was a few years ago. But like, it's sort of like, yeah, it's like brands behaving badly is totally breaking through. It can break through the clutter, I suppose.
It's funny you mentioned them. So I know both of those, their previous social media managers for like at the time. I'm fairly decent friends with them. I don't want to say like we're best buddies or whatever, but yeah, like I know them pretty well. And
really?
Yeah. And it's interesting because before, like I mentioned at the beginning, before I got on the Steakums account, I didn't really know much about Twitter culture. So I didn't have pretext for like brands or whatever was trending. Like I didn't know about Wendy's. I didn't know about Moon Pie. But then I quickly discovered, especially Moon Pie, because that was it. They went viral for the first time, or at least on like a mass level, literally right when I started on the Steakum account. So when I saw that go viral, I was like, oh, like I got jealous and I wanted to be that. I was like, here's a brand that I'm trying to break out. And this one over here just broke out like that. So it became like a friendly competition type of thing. And similar to Wendy's, I mean, like they kind of paved the path in a lot of ways. There were brands way before Wendy's in like 2013, 2012 even, that were doing similar stuff, but not at the level that they brought it to. Like they made it, I think like the Wendy's Twitter was literally featured on Anderson Cooper. I mean, it was like, like a national phenomenon on Twitter. So it's been interesting watching the kind of progression of brands since then to now to do what they do.
It's funny.
I was just going to say, is this kind of stuff short-lived? Do you feel like, I mean,
well, it's, The trend of brands on Twitter specifically, like I said, it's been going on really since the beginning of Twitter. You can trace it to 2007, 2008, but it didn't really pick up till 2013 with like Denny's Diner was one of the first big ones, and Arby's. It's always fast food restaurants and CPG brands. But I think often like, yeah, like where is the sort of inevitable conclusion? I think one trend I can say the past few years since I got started in this, at least, is that there's less and less Steakum and Wendy's that happen. Like you, once in a while you see an account like the New Jersey government account was a viral one that blew up. Obviously it's not a food brand, but similar brand essence, whatever. And they became pretty iconicized once that, cause that was like the first government account that was being like weird at that like high of a level. there were ones prior to it. There's like the Pennsylvania Treasury has an account, and there's similar ones that do it, but they like really were a big and they blew it up. And but there's less and less of those. So one trend that we see is as the space gets more crowded, more brands kind of focus on like micro communities because it's mm-hmm. harder and harder to break through at that macro level. So yeah, it's hard to say if it's going away or if it's just kind of changing to that more micro level.
So what's your creative process? You gotta put something out. You want it to resonate. Like what's your process? How do you come up with ideas? You know, how do you formulate them? Like what, share some secrets with us.
I feel like I'm not alone in terms of creatives, where a lot of my thoughts just randomly, they spontaneously will pop into my mind. Like I'll be in the shower, I'll be walking our dog, doing just random stuff. And then you get a thought and I have to drop everything and jump on Twitter and write a draft out to make sure the seed is planted for later to kind of explore. But it's tough to say. Like, so I guess maybe the applicable way of answering that question is like when I'm not feeling like the sort of spark of creativity, like what do I do? It can range from reading. Like sometimes I'll go through a book. Like I've been paging through Julia Galef's new book. She's part of like the Rational Sphere, blogosphere online. And it's a great book for paging through because it's just packed with these like little isms, you know, like things that might be a useful thing to tweet about, you know, like a paragraph might have a term I've never heard of, or something that is just super relatable. And I'll be like, okay, take a picture on my phone, write that down for later that I might like further explore on my own. And that tends to be how I come up with ideas when I'm not feeling inspired. So like whether it's reading a book or watching a YouTube video or reading an article or whatever it might be, or even just scrolling through Twitter, you know, you see content, you're consuming, and then you figure out like, here's a sort of like a brain child that I can like build out of this piece that I just found. You know, it's like, I guess that's how I mean, there's like the cliche that nothing's original. I mean, everybody kind of like you copy whatever you see. And that's definitely rings true to me. Like, I don't have a ton of like original thoughts. I don't come up with the stuff I tweet about. Like, it usually starts from something I've consumed before, and then I kind of just extrapolate from there and figure out like, where can I fit this into other areas and kind of like to make it a cool thought to communicate. Yeah. So it's boring, but that's generally it.
But like, a good idea strikes me as it would only be half the battle, right? Like, what do you do once you have the idea? How do you?
Okay, I got you. Yeah. So Google Docs are my best friend. I don't know about you, but it's actually sad. Like, my wife makes fun of me all the time. My Google Docs are just a disaster. I just have like dozens and dozens of documents, many that started and never finished. And they're just dumps of information. Like, yeah. I'll do what I just said, where I'll find content and kind of like paste it into there. And then I just start writing. Like, I don't think about it. I just start writing. Like, I plant the thought there, rattle off whatever first comes to my mind. And then 9 out of 10 times, everything sucks. And I'm like, okay, well, this is all garbage and I never touch it again. But that so one like time, yeah, that one time, know, it's like this for me. That's what I'm
saying. 100% relatable, Nathan.
Yeah, totally.
But you know, that one time, like that great thought, you're like, okay, like this, again, it's not, it might not be fully original, but the way that I had just kind of framed it is a way I haven't seen it framed before. And that can maybe be useful to somebody. And that's one, because there's like a million cliche things that I've picked up over the years from random, whether it's crash course videos or articles I've read or whatever, that I'm like, it'd be easy, like low hanging fruit, to kind of just like throw this out there. It's almost like a cliche at this point, but I try to look for things that they, even if they're common to people like you guys, you know, people that are in circles that are highly like into these areas, it might be common to you or like some other extremely online nerds, but for most people, they haven't like heard or seen this idea presented in that way. And that, those are the things that I try to look for.
It's funny because we write for an audience that is extremely well informed in everything we write in, and it creates its own type of anxiety and trials. And it's interesting for you. You approach it as, yeah, nobody's going to know any of this stuff, and I didn't make it up, and that's fine. You're just sort of acting as like a conduit of ideas and information.
Which is a lot easier than what you do, because I get to kind of play to a general audience. Like, I can take, like, for example, concept like the third person effect, which is just this, I don't even know, it's a theory. So I don't even know how like empirical it is, but the theory is that, you know, it's possible that there's certain people who, when they believe that they themselves are more immune to certain forms of propaganda or information, that it actually can make than other people. Like, they think, oh, those people over there are susceptible, not me. And that can actually make them more susceptible to like other forms of propaganda or whatever. Like, that's the theory. And it's something that I've, you know, seen written about, talked about, whatever, but I know that that's not like a super commonly disseminated idea. So I'll take something like that and then figure out like, how can I frame this up in an interesting way for a general audience? Whereas there's always that like 1 to 3 or 5% of people who read that and they're like, this is old news. Like, I read about
it.
You're like, all right, well, you're not my people. But with you, what all you do is a lot different, because it is people that are actively informed and engaged in these spaces. So you do have to kind of like frame things in a lot more highly, like, you know, expert ways that take more time and more energy sorting out, which I'm thankful I don't have to get that deep into the weeds with most of what I do.
You know, it's interesting. What you said resonates with me a lot, especially with my experience with podcasting. It's like, if you're going to put yourself out there, 20% of people are going to pan you and like pan the hell out of you. Yep. And you almost have to just wipe them from your mind, or else you just won't be able to do anything.
Yeah, it's paralyzing. It messes with your head. That's what I'm saying. Like, especially on a personal level, just because ever since I started doing the brand stuff, obviously I spend more time on Twitter and these platforms generally on a personal level, because I consume most of my media personally, which then translates to the brand stuff. And in doing that, you know, the people who spend every day online engaging these topics, like, they are engaged in discourses and in culture wars and in subjects that are like beaten to the ground that most people I know in real life who aren't that online have never even heard of.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing, right? Be like, you got to figure out, like, okay, who are my people? Like, the 20% you just mentioned, I guess when that 20% becomes like 50 or 60%, then you kind of have to like rethink what you're doing. But as long as it's like a vocal minority, you're always going to have that element of your audience who is with you and aligned with you, and they follow the same content and they know the same stuff, and you're just kind of like preaching to the choir at that point. But it's unavoidable to a certain extent.
Well, first of all, Joe, stop reading my course evaluations. Do you, Nathan, worry about like stepping into some esoteric like Twitter beef that you were not aware of, and then like having, you know, a bunch of pitchfork wielding Twitter bot coming after you?
I've been there, Dan, a few times. Especially like there's been a couple times in the past year that I've posted some kind of like, I don't want to say appeals to authority, because that's not really what they were, but you could take that from them, I guess. But they're posts that were framed like, you need to trust experts when it comes to certain forms of information, etc. And, you know, like these processes that these experts use, you know, they're tested and they go on for years oftentimes and blah, blah, blah. But I had several people, like, this is just one example. This happens all the time. But I had this during this post that was going viral. There were several people that were like, it looks like Steakum's never heard of the replication crisis. And I was just like, obviously, like, I know what the replication crisis is. Like, I'm not going to be posting about like the publisher perish narratives that go on in academia through this meat brand. Like, I mean, I guess I could. Maybe that was my error. Like, maybe it was like a sort of arrogance that I had that I should have included like a cat. Because I think I've talked somewhat about it, like hinted at it, but I've never done like a deep dive into something like that. It's because talk about esoteric. Like, it's not something that most people that are following this content are going to care that much about. And the ones who will care tend to be conspiracy theorists and people who I don't really want to attract. We're going to be like, see, like Steakum says, you know, like you can't trust anybody. So there's stuff like that that happens where like people point out like a critique or something that I didn't include in the post. Oftentimes it's something that I either didn't want to talk about or I can't talk about. Like, people bring up like capitalism and shit. And I'm like, guys, like I can't say certain stuff. Like, I'm not going to be like railing on capitalism or whatever through this brand account. Like, I can, you know, play around with certain critiques and social critiques and frame them in lukewarm ways. But that's always been a main critique of a lot of the more extremely online people, which is like, well, the brand is so moderate. It's so milquetoast. It's like, yeah, it's a brand. It's trying to appeal to a lot of people and not esoteric, extremely online social critics who just want to tear everything down every second. So yeah, but I do deal with that a lot. And I try to, this is something maybe you all can relate to this. Like, I do try to balance when I see that stuff, because oftentimes my knee jerk response is just like, screw you. Like, that's stupid. I do try to balance like, when there is like a good thoughtful critique, even if it's buried in like trolling or aggression, something that I might not like. Cause you know, oftentimes critique is not like a perfectly emotionally contained thing. Usually it has all this baggage attached to it. So I do think it's important to be able to like juggle that, you know, when you're posting through things and learning about topics that you're not an expert in, which I'm not. So that's always a struggle, but like we're saying, it is what it is. Like, you just kind of, at one point, it's like with any kind of work, at one point you just have to hit publish and just own all the flaws and own all the stuff that's all the outcomes that you can't control. And that's just part of what you got to do, or else you just never get anything done. So
that's like the difficulty in Twitter, though, right? It's like there's no nuance. I mean, I know that there's a whole vein of fuck nuance in sociology. But
that's what Tina Fetner said he read. He read Kieran's paper on fuck nuance.
I don't know if I have. Maybe I don't think I have. Maybe Maybe if I pulled it up, it would ring some bells, but.
Yeah, but it's like without doing, you know, like, I mean, I've read that people don't get past like the first post in a thread anyway, but like without doing a 10-point thread every time with lots of asterisks and like follow-ups, right? Like how do you get your message across in the 280 characters or whatever it is now?
And that's the fun part about what we all do, what you all do, what I do. It's like the figuring out like where are those lines, because everybody has different lines. Like a brand is going to have much different lines than a professor is going to have, and you have to learn like where is it worth including a caveat to kind of like add that nuance, and where is it worth just like putting your foot down? Because sometimes when you put your foot down, I'm sure even as a professor, I've never taught a class. I've guest spoken at several like college level courses, and it's fun to sometimes like put your foot down in an area that you kind of know is a little polarizing, because then that provokes conversation, it provokes thought, and it often pushes people. Like me, like I was the worst student ever. Like I hated school. I'm not a great like traditional learner, and that was one of the only things that would get me to engage with a topic, is when a teacher would say something kind of provocative, and then that like wakes you up almost, and you're like, okay, now I'm paying attention, and now my brain's moving. So I don't know. It's a balancing act. Everybody's got to figure that out, and it's a fun part of it.
About the, you know, the nasty comments, the you didn't read this. I feel like that's more grad school stuff than what you would find among professionals. I think my experience of our environment is that it's quite supportive. And
Yeah, that's true. I don't get really that much. The criticism I do get from, you know, the sort of professor level, or like just people in the field in general level, it's almost always more thoughtful, unless it's somebody that has a bone to pick with the account or me. Like there's been specifically like, you know, just certain experts, I won't name them, who may hate me. And like,
oh really?
Oh yeah, dude. I have people. It's the stuff. People don't even believe me when I tell them the stuff that I get sent, like the death threats and the. I've been swatted.
Whoa, really?
Yeah, I've had just crazy. Just people, because it's Twitter, and people take things super seriously. And again, like in part at a sort of top. Ambiguous macro level, I kind of understand the morality of some of this stuff. If you're someone who hates consumerism, if you hate capitalism, if you hate all the sort of players and advertising and everything, and you see this brand doing something that you view as like malicious to society, it's going to make sense that you're going to feel compelled to like project some level of angst or hatred toward it or whatever. But it's unfortunate that oftentimes it gets leveraged at me personally in very bizarre and sometimes I don't want to say scary. I mean, I guess it is scary. It's weird admitting that, but like, it's tough to grapple with it, because you're like, okay, on one hand, I understand the angst and the frustration, and I would love to like grapple more with that. On the other hand, if someone's telling me they're gonna like skin me alive or something, that's like what am I supposed to say to that? Like, it's like a bizarre tension that you kind of have to deal with. But luckily, those are few and far between comparatively to. The support or whatever, but you know, it's one negative comment says a lot more than 100 positive.
Oh, ones. For sure. Right. Although imagine there's a professor out there whose chief intellectual rival is Steak'em.
Right. I'm sure there's some that want it to be, because like they know it'll get them attention. For
yeah, no
work.
Kidding.
I can believe it. I can believe it.
So let me ask you this. Here's a question. What do academics as a group do well, and like where do you think we really need to reappraise how we go about doing things, especially in terms of, you know, communicating our ideas, interacting with the rest of conversant society? Where are we just awful, and where are we all right?
This is a hard question. I've been thinking about this for a long time, and obviously a lot of the Steak'em stuff kind of touches on parts of it, but I think in large part, it's what we've been talking about this whole time. It's a kind of split between the ivory tower aspect of academia, which is really hard to grapple with, I think, especially for people within it. Because I think I know a lot of professors and people that either have worked in these institutions or researchers or whatever, and oftentimes they're super kind and otherwise like normal seeming people. So I think when you get this like stigma. Seeming. Yeah, well, you know, I didn't say I know them.
We're super well.
You never know what's underneath, but But you know, you I think oftentimes people, they get into these fields and then they realize the stigma is attached to what they're doing, and then it becomes tough to shake it, and it almost becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy where like you're trying to, like, there's certain people I've known for the past 10 or so years, especially on like Facebook, like people I've grew up with that are in these spaces, and it's interesting to watch how they have evolved in that this time period, like learning to communicate, like on Facebook particularly, it's where just more people I know personally are, just like their messaging. And like sometimes I'll get like a Facebook memory and I'll look back to something from 10 years ago that I was like engaging with like a post, and it'll be kind of like from a professor or something like that. It'll be like really condescending sounding, but I can remember at that point 10 years ago when I saw that and engaged with it, they didn't mean it to sound like that at all. Like they were just trying to get an idea across, but it just has that, like, in hindsight now, it's like a tonal thing. So I think being in that tension and like allowing that tension to kind of seep in and like, and owning some of the things, because a lot of this, when we talk about, you know, what, how we can do certain things better like this, it almost all comes down to perception. It's not like an objective thing. Like, you know, how you sound to your colleagues is going to come across completely different to how you sound to your friends, to how you sound to strangers and different audiences. So I think existing in that tension and like also working, if you can work, even whether it's professionally or personally, like with people who communicate with just everyday people, like if you're trying to communicate to everyday people as like an expert in academia or whatever, like whether you're writing a book or a paper or something like that, obviously a lot of papers are meant to stay in academia, but if you're trying to write something that communicates or do a podcast that communicates to everyday people, it just helps to talk to them. I mean, I don't know. It's like anything else. Like I even catch myself, like now that I'm in this kind of like amorphous brand space and even just Twitter more generally, where it is a lot more elitist, and a lot of the people I resonate with are like philosophy people, and you know, like people that are just high-minded with their opinions, because they challenge me and I like to absorb what they're saying and doing. But then it's like the more you do that, the more you kind of create your new, I hate the term echo chamber, but that's kind of what it is. Like you kind of create your new community, and then you kind of detach from like those normal kind of like loser people you went to high school with or whatever, the more you just lose touch with how normal people communicate. And I think everybody does this in various like fields, whether it is advertising, whether it's academia, whether it's science or whatever. And I think existing in that tension and being able to, like I said, either professionally or personally, kind of like work with people like, hey, like, what do you, how does this read to you? Like I did an article recently just on my blog about a like vaccine hesitation. And as I was writing it, I was thinking like, man, I wonder, like I'm writing this in a way, I was trying to target it toward just vaccine hesitant people who aren't like conspiracy theorists, anti-vax, just people who have genuine concerns and they're maybe on the fence. And so I was trying to target them. But I was like, man, like who's somebody I can, you know, get to read this? So I sent it to a couple, like some family and some friends that were in that boat, like two of them actually that were in that boat, just to read it. And I was just like, hey, you know, like I'm not looking for like grammatical feedback. Just how does this sound to you? Like, does it sound condescending? Does it sound whatever? And just, I don't know, like that's just one example. But like, stuff like that is super helpful, I think, just to stay engaged with how to communicate to people. Because it's not a catch-all. There's no like magic bullet to being able to do it. You just have to always, it's just like culture, it's like you have to always be engaged with that tension, or else I think you just gradually slowly over time lose touch in those ways, and then you continue to insulate yourself into areas that you're going to get direct feedback from other experts that talk like you, which is not
right
super helpful when you're, especially on Twitter or wherever, or you can kind of get into these patterns. So I don't know, that's a rough idea.
I think that's quite profound, you know, because there are a lot of pressures, especially depending on where you work. You could find yourself entirely sealed up with other academics and not even barely coming into contact with people who aren't at the university. A lot of people in the university world are quite surprised that like only a third of people go to university or, you know, higher ed, you know, there's like whole world of people.
Right. And a lot of those people, I feel like also, maybe this is just anecdotal, but I feel that a lot of people in those spaces have like a distaste toward people, whether it's their family, quote unquote, back home, you know, whether it's like maybe they came from the Midwest or some southern, like a more red state or something, and they left that community to be part of academia or whatever circle they're in now. So they kind of have this like this idea of like, oh, I was part of that community, but I left it. Like, I'm above that now. And I don't think that's a conscious thought necessarily. It's more like subconsciously baked into their actions. It's like, you know, it's like the age old cliche of, you know, you leave one tribe and then you join another tribe and then you like you adapt similar traits that your old tribe had without knowing that it's happening, because it's just kind of like you rejected it, you thought you moved on, but really you're like embodying it in just like the opposite way oftentimes. And I think that's really hard for people to grapple with, because it forces you to like internalize and think critically, and a lot of times it leads to people having to go to therapy and all sorts of stuff that they don't want to do. So it's hard to think through that stuff.
But it's also, you know, what I loved when I met you was how little formal sociology training that you had received, because to me, I think your stuff is great, and it goes to show that there are people who can engage in this stuff really well, who have a natural knack, and they exist outside of the university. Mm-hmm. It was a great reminder, and it's one of my favorite things about having met you.
Well, that means a lot. It does. I can't say it doesn't tickle my ego. Like, it's definitely a nice thing to hear. And I do. Yeah. Like I said, I am just a hobbyist. Like, my wife, she's a big video game person. She reads a lot. Like, reads a lot of fantasy, I should say, like a lot of fiction. And she, you know, she does dog walking. She's kind of into like a lot of just like what I would consider to be healthy, normal hobbies. And then I'll be walking around the house listening to like debates on YouTube or old old lectures from the 1960s, and she's just like, "You nerd, like, what are you doing?"
Yeah,
I don't know. It's just since I was a kid, like, I grew up in a really strong ideological household, and I grappled with that a lot growing up, and it kind of just became part of who I am. And I've always wanted to kind of learn and figure out, you know, what's true about various topics. And in doing that, I guess you learn your limits, and you can just adapt to these fields, and you figure out, you know, what works and what doesn't work. And I like, that's why I think I said to you in the email, Joe, like, maybe I didn't frame it this way, but like, I don't read like articles or books or whatever, or listen to lectures to like for learning's sake. Like, I'm always like, it's always a means to an end to me, which maybe it's sad. Like, I do love learning, but it's always like, how can I take bits from this and like apply it, whether it's to my work or even just my life, like something I can use, you know?
I think we all do that. I think once you leave college and you have an actual job, and if your job is producing scientific, you know, communications, you're going in it exactly the same way. Okay. I think.
Yeah. Okay. It feels dirty sometimes, you know, it's just kind of like,
I
read a book and then I put it down when it stops serving me. That type of thing, you know, it's like, okay, well, whatever. I got what I needed from this video. I don't need to go back or support. I don't know. Maybe I'm speaking in sharp terms, but like, yeah, it's something that feels a little weird to be like, okay, I'm more looking to be the most right about something. You know what I mean? Versus like just the general passion for knowledge, which I guess I have, but it's often overridden by my work. So it is what it is.
Can I actually follow up on that? So this was a question I posed in terms of like the meta-ness of it all. I feel like that sort of piggybacks on that. Is this like, how do you deal with that? And how do you deal with sort of, I mean, you kind of talked about it before, where people were coming at you about capitalism and consumerism. Like, how do you deal with the pushback about the fact that it is a brand, you know, trying to make these social messages?
Well, Sarah, it breaks my brain. First of all, my wife's a vegan, or I guess she's vegetarian. She's vegan for a few years. I used to have like arguments about the sort of philosophical implications of, you know, animal cruelty and factory farming and all that. And these are things I'm not. I think about this stuff all the time. I think about whether it's systemic, you know, issues or just interpersonal stuff. Like, even I think a lot of my skill, if you can call it that, at my job comes from the fact that I've always hated advertising. I mean, I grew up, my dad started our agency when it was like the early 90s, right around the time I was born. It's like a small town thing. He was just working with like local businesses. And I grew up like as a child, like hanging out in his office. It was like a small little space. And by the time I became a teenager and I started like, I remember like, you know, reading Chomsky and whatever and pretending I knew what it meant, and like just thinking, like, I had this like amorphous vision in my mind of like consumerism is bad, and like in advertising is bad because it perpetuates consumerism. And I've obviously since then kind of rounded out a little bit more of a nuanced view of these systems, but that's always stuck with me. It's always been this, like, again, I use the word tension a lot because that's kind of how I live, but it's something I've just always had to think about. And like when I started the Steak'em stuff started to succeed, that was when it became like super real, because I was like, man, crap, I didn't picture myself doing this for a living. Like I was a musician before I got into advertising. I always met, like, I literally have songs about like not selling out and crap like that. And you know, this is all very interpersonal, and I think like anyone who knows me is aware of this, and it's just something that I do try to stay keen to. But at the end of the day, I don't know, like there's the certain argument I hear sometimes online where it'll be somebody like me will say, well, I'm just doing my job. And then there's always that anonymous account that's like, well, you know who else said that? The Nazis or whatever.
Yeah, whatever.
And you're like, okay. Like I could see the sort of philosophical implications of like, you know, boiling down an argument to that. But at the same time, like there are certain lines that everybody just has to draw. It's like, all right, you know, you buy your clothes from the sweatshop, or you got your smartphones, or you're existing in a system, and you have to figure out like,
oh yeah,
where those lines are. Like even like, I don't know if any of you saw this, it was a stupid discourse that happened the other week, but the whole thing about that Twitch streamer, Hassan Piker, buying the $3 million.
Oh yeah.
In West Hollywood. And he's like a he's a socialist. And like, there's all this discourse over like, obviously like there's like the stupid discourse, which is like socialists shouldn't have money. And that's just like a dumb meme critique. But the interesting critique is like, where are those lines? Because this is someone who's like professing anti-capitalist philosophy, and someone who's all about, you know, wants to live in a society where like workers own the means of production, etc., and wants less wealth inequality. So like, where are those lines? Like, he just bought a $3 million mansion. No one's saying you can't have nice things, but like, is there a certain point where you should like live your principles in a certain way that aligns more with reality? And I think someone like that, who's making that kind of money, has a lot more room to live those principles versus someone who's, you know, working at a McDonald's for $7 an hour and can barely make rent. So there's obviously a scale for this stuff, and I don't know where I fit into that scale, but it's something I think a lot about, and that maybe makes me better at my job. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe it makes me worse. I overthink everything. But
my understanding is Noam Chomsky's quite wealthy, and all of his books are copywritten and distributed by commercial printing presses and sold on royalties. So, you know, I don't know.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I think you live in society, yet critique society meme that's kind of like blown up. I get annoyed by it because that the stupid critique is the one that, yeah, you're making money or you're working for a big corporation. That's bad. You shouldn't do that. That's stupid. Like, obviously people do have to participate in society and therefore participate in systems that social systems of inequality and things that perpetuate harm to others in the world or whatever. And that's just a reality of how we all have to live. But there are interesting lines that I think individuals can draw. And I do live in a weird tension where I'm like kind of like living with my work in opposition to a lot of my principles, and I don't know how. Like, you try to do your best, but that's like the irony. Talk about the meta stuff with Steak'em. It's like trying to do my best in that by telling people it's marketing creates this whole new meta layer of like anti-marketing marketing, where like it's working doubly almost by what's happening. So it's like somebody like me can't win. It's like there's not really like a principled position in an industry like this. Like, no matter what you do to raise awareness or educate people or whatever, you're always going to be wrestling with that. So point being, think about it, but I used to have really bad anxiety and panic attacks. And there's a certain cost that comes with overthinking things. And I think you got to draw a line somewhere.
So we got to finish up. I can't believe how fast this is, but before we leave, I wanted to just pick your brains about careers in social media and marketing. There are a lot of highly skilled young sociologists who are all, hitching their hopes to, disappearing professor jobs. And there's a wealth of great careers that people with our skills can, pursue. And one of them is absolutely marketing. I used to be in the marketing faculty at Temple University before I went to Queen's College. I mean, a good chunk of their discipline is sociology. So if someone loves what you're doing and would love to be doing something like that, taking their background, taking their communication skills, their ability to reason and engage, what do you recommend they do?
That's a great question. The number one thing I tell everybody, whether it's friends or strangers that hit me up online about jobs, is make a portfolio. Like, it could be in the form of a website, it can be a blog, it can be literally a Google Doc that just has links to your work and summaries or whatever. But I get a lot of messages from people that are like, hey, you know, can you help me out? Like, refer me or hook me up to whatever. And I'll be like, okay, like what have you done? Like what can you tell me about yourself? Like what is there, you know, that I can show? Because anytime whether it's a recruiter or somebody I know personally who's like, hey, I'm looking for a copywriter or a social media manager in this space, anytime they do that and I send them a name, almost anytime they're like, okay, like, can you vouch for them? And two, like, why, like, what is their thing? Like, what, like, why are you referencing them? So that's like the most important thing. I think, just doing the work is something that gets neglected so much. Like, there's tons of people, some of the smartest people I know haven't published anything, whether it's tweets or articles or whatever. And it's like, there's a lot of like fear, I think, of the internet being forever and just like people that are perfectionists, never wanting to finish an article or a piece or whatever. And I think you just have to, it's like we were saying before, like, yeah, at one point you got to hit publish in all its imperfections. And the more you do it, the better at it you get. And that's just 9 out of 10 times. Like, there's so many people, even when I've hired personally, like at our agency, I've gone through, I guess, hundreds at this point of resumes. Most recruiters don't have time to go through just like a list of like, okay, you went to this college, you have this certification, whatever. Like, that's great, but it doesn't tell me anything about what you're capable of doing. Like, there's been at least 10, maybe 15 or 20 people over the years that I've referred to jobs who had no experience in like marketing or social media, but they had a really active Twitter presence, maybe a couple of viral tweets, maybe some articles that they've published. And I could be like, all right, like, I can vouch for this person. Like, I know their work. I know they're good at what they're doing. They understand internet culture and they're like in tune with a lot of like emotionally intelligent, whatever you want to call it, you know? So I think doing the work and being able to show it is the most important thing for employers nowadays. And just like, you know, networking. I mean, that's not an uncommon thing in academia. And just meet the right people and don't be afraid to reach out. I think whether it's you guys or even myself or anybody, everybody likes talking about themselves, like everybody. So it's like, a way to get in a lot of circles is literally just to start reaching out, whether it's privately or publicly, and just like ask questions to people, and like they'll most likely answer them, unless it's like, you know, some celebrity. Like, if it's somebody like within reach, you know, just kind of reach out, build connections that way. And also just try to be sincere about it. I mean, obviously everybody's got a bottom line that they're trying to reach when they reach out to somebody like that. But just be as sincere as you can and just do the work. And hopefully, you know, it's not a perfect meritocracy anywhere, but like, hopefully that'll hedge your bets to giving you the best shot at getting in somewhere.
Nathan Alabach, the man behind Stakem Twitter. It was such a treat to meet you. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, pleasure's mine. It's been fun. Thanks for letting me ramble with you all.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. A special thank you to our guest, Nathan Alabach from Alabach Communications, the man behind the Stakem Twitter account. Also, a special thank you to my co-host today, Sarah Patterson from the University of Michigan and Daniel Morrison from Abilene Christian University. We're on the web, theannexpodcast.com, on Twitter @SociAnnex, and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. The Annex is a production of the Queen's Podcast Lab. For more information, visit queenspodcastlab.org. Music by Lena Orsa. On behalf of Sarah Patterson and Daniel Morrison, I'm Joe Cohen. Thanks for listening.